It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Comedian Jim Gaffigan won my heart with all of his takeoffs on the great American diet. In fact, his new book is Food, A Love Story. And it all started in his childhood.
Growing up, my father loved steak, and he would make an announcement that would make you assume that Abraham Lincoln was coming over for dinner. He'd be like, "We're going to have steak." And me and my brothers would be like, "Who cares?" But now I love going to a steakhouse. I love the way they're darkly lit and the rituals in a steakhouse. I love when they wheel out the raw cuts of meat and they kind of thrust the pieces of meat at the table. They're like, "You can get this and you can get this." And men are so visual, we kind of drool and go, "Yeah, that one. So I love all those elements of steak.
Comedian Jim Gaffigan and lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Jim Gaffigan is a comedian who loves to eat. In fact, he wrote a hilarious best-selling book on parenting called Dad is Fat. And he has five kids, by the way, so he knows what he's talking about. Food obviously figured large in that book, and it figures even larger in his latest, Food, A Love Story. Jim, good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, you have so much of your comedy being based on food. Do you come from a family of eaters?
Well, I come from a large family, so there was definitely an element of competing for food. And the environment informed me that I should eat immediately before someone else gets it. So, I mean, I'm the youngest of six, so it was eat it whether you're hungry or not. And I think that kind of stayed with me.
What were holidays like at your house when you were a kid?
Well, holidays were very important. Probably the most important was Thanksgiving. I mean, a big thing in our family was Sunday dinner. Probably the peak of Sunday dinner would be Thanksgiving, but it always took place at the dining table in our living room. And my dad was a banker, so there was always some formality. Maybe not a tie, but there was definitely itchy clothes that had to occur, and there was my mom's wedding china that for some reason couldn't be put in the dishwasher. I think it had to be cleaned with a kitten. Just very ornate, complex things. And it was, you know, my mom would pull off, interesting meals that, you know, to my 8-year-old palate, I just want a McDonald's, right? But Sunday dinner or holidays, it was always a big event with cloth napkins and, you know, my dad smoking right next to me while I was trying to eat. It was an interesting thing. I think that the conversations at Sunday dinner or at Thanksgiving or family gatherings coming from a big family were really instrumental in me, you know, learning and kind of gaining perspective on life. I remember being 10 and my father asking me my views on Vietnam, and the Vietnam War had been over, but I knew it was a country, but that was about it. So there was definitely an element of being thrown into the fire at those family dinners.
I think a lot of us can relate to family meals like that. But how about now? I mean, what's your relationship with food like now? For example, do you have any particular food obsessions?
Well, I go through different obsessions. I would say my recent one is probably steak, which growing up, my father loved steak, and he would make an announcement that we were going to have steak kind of in a way, you know, that would make you assume that Abraham Lincoln was coming over for dinner. He'd be like, "We're going to have steak." And me and my brothers would be like, "Who cares?" But and he would cook it on the grill, and he would, you know, go in the back of our kind of backyard area in the pitch darkness after he had asked, you know, one of his kids to light the grill where we almost died lighting it. And then he would cook the steaks, usually burn them, and there would be cigarette ashes on them as we ate, but just a flavor of it. It's not like it was a mess. And it's so now at my age, I've grown to love steak, and the steak experience is something that I get. I didn't understand it as a kid. Now I love going to a steakhouse. I love the way they're darkly lit and the waiters are no nonsense. Like, you're getting a steak, you want a steak? And I'm like, yes, ma'am, I want a steak. I love every element of a steakhouse. There's something strange about the rituals in a steakhouse. I love when they wheel out the raw cuts of meat and they kind of thrust the raw pieces of meat at the table. They're like, you can get this. And you can get this. And men are so kind of visual, we kind of drool and go, yeah, that one. So I love all those elements of steak. So that's my fascination right now is steak, I would say.
Let's talk about your children. You've got 5 kids at home.
Yeah.
What do they eat? And what's food like at your house?
Well, it's, you know, I have 5 kids. I haven't talked to my wife in an hour, so there could be more. There is a lot. And our oldest is 10 and our youngest is 2. So there is different levels of eating occurring. Sometimes, you know, the 2-year-old doesn't even, you know, reach his mouth with some of the eating. But I would say, you know, my wife is a very positive influence and there's no hot pockets being served. It's very much a lot of green vegetables and I do my best to pretend to like all the healthy food. But I would say that it's scary because I am somebody who enjoys eating and I'll see it sometimes in my children. But, you know, when they're young, their behavior can change every 3 months. So just when I'm worried that some kid's going to have my unhealthy view of unhealthy love of eating, you know, 3 months later, they won't eat anything at dinner because they're just not interested.
So how do vegetables go over at your house?
Well, I think that vegetables, in general, people don't like them. I think there is a vegetable plate at when you go to someone's party and there's a vegetable plate. There's always a part of us that's like, oh, wow, that's a waste of money. That'll just be tossed out. That's not going to compete with guacamole and chips or anything. The crudité is just French for throwaway in a couple hours. So vegetables in general, and I don't mean the fake vegetables, potatoes and corn, which are actually enjoyable. There's such an effort that has to go in to making a vegetable delicious. And the amount of olive oil or butter or salt that you need to add to broccoli, I think is amazing. Now, that being said, I live in New York City. When I do go to California, I am impressed that vegetables actually have flavor. But generally, I'm not a fan of vegetables. I kind of, you know, I just view a cucumber as a pickle before it started drinking. You know, there's just different vegetables that once you add salt or vinegar or some kind of form of dairy, they're impressive, but without them, they're relatively worthless.
Hey, Jim, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Jim Gaffigan is author of Food, A Love Story. Now, in his honor, check out a recipe for hanger steak with Gremolata. It's at splendidtable.org. Now, this is serious. The homemade pretzel is threatened with extinction, and I am not talking about the blah, soulless mall pretzel or the crispy miniatures. I am talking the great tradition of the true pretzel. A pretzel that is big, yeasty, hand-looped, and it's a mouthful of goodness studded with hefty salt crystals. The ever-curious David Leet has found the homemade pretzel maven, Andrea Sloniker, and she's written Pretzel Making at Home.
Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Pretzels are so ubiquitous here in America, but of course they have a very rich and foreign history. Tell me a little bit about how it all began and how it got here to America.
Sure. Well, it's believed that they were invented in the year 610 by monks along the Mediterranean, actually, somewhere where Italy and France now meet. And it's believed that they were first invented as little rewards for children for learning their prayers. So a monk tore off a piece of dough, shaped it into this twist that was meant to represent a child's arms crossed over his chest in prayer, which is how people would have prayed back then, and gave it to the children if they learned the scripture.
Wow.
Yeah. And then another plausible theory, though, there's a lot of folklore and a lot of legends. We don't know really what's true, but another theory is that it was sustenance for monks during the Lenten fast, and the three holes in the pretzel were meant to represent the Holy Trinity.
Ah, okay.
So they came to America in the 19th century with the Pennsylvania Dutch immigrants that settled in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. By the way, I wanted to mention that Pennsylvanians eat 12 times as many pretzels as the rest of the country.
Are you serious?
That was, yeah. I did go there to research the book, of course, for that very reason. And they have a lot of pretzel bakeries in Pennsylvania. The Italian immigrants in Philadelphia kind of adopted this curious bread that they'd never seen and started baking them in Philadelphia and selling them on street corners. And even hard pretzels were invented actually in America in the Pennsylvania Dutch country when a young apprentice baker forgot a batch of pretzels in the oven overnight. The ovens went cold, but the pretzels remained in there and hardened overnight. And the baker decided to try selling them the next day. And thus, America's favorite snack food was invented.
Interesting. So tell me, how did this interest in home pretzel making start?
Well, it began about 5 years ago when I began seeing pretzels on menus at various restaurants around the country. They were in artisan bakeries, being mm-hmm. used as the sandwich bread. And I just really was curious about why I had all of a sudden started seeing it everywhere I went. And so I started researching, what is a pretzel? And that led me to start tinkering in my kitchen with baking them myself. Mm-hmm. And what really makes it a pretzel, I think, is the fact that it's dipped in an alkaline solution before mm-hmm. baking. And that's what gives it that really amazing crust, that characteristic flavor, that leathery texture, dark color that we expect with a pretzel.
I want to talk a bit about this alkaline solution you're talking about, because traditionally in Germany they use lye, which is an alkaline solution, which can be caustic. But you found a very ingenious way of substituting that.
Well, I was really lucky at the time that I started researching pretzels because mm-hmm. The amazing food scientist Harold McGee had just come out with an article in the New York Times about how to basically create a substance that is similar to lye in your home kitchen, but not mm-hmm. quite as caustic and much more readily available. And that is by taking baking soda, spreading it out on a baking pan, and putting it into the oven at about 250 to 300 degrees for about an hour. And that changes the chemical properties in the baking soda to make it behave more similarly to lye.
So after the baking soda comes out of the oven and it cools, what do you do with it to make the pretzels?
Sure. So you begin with a dough. You shape mm-hmm. it into that iconic shape.
Right.
And then you dip them in an alkaline solution, which then would be the baked baking soda and water. And it's mm-hmm. a small percentage of baking soda to water. You dip the pretzels into the solution, put them on a baking sheet, pop them in the oven, and then you have freshly made
homemade pretzels.
Yes, exactly. In Germany, they come in knots and sticks and rolls and twists and all sorts of different shapes that are used for making sandwiches or just for eating with butter at breakfast time. And even in America, I've seen croissants dipped in the lye solution and baked, or pretzel dogs, pretzel pigs in a blanket. So you can come up with all sorts of different pretzelized creations, I like to say.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Andrea. Thank you.
You too, David. Thanks a lot.
Andrea Sloniker is author of Pretzel Making at Home. David Leet is publisher of Leet's Culinaria, lccooks.com. Now try Andrea's recipe for Pennsylvania Dutch hard pretzels. This could be a great weekend project. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a bootleg Thai market in a park in Berlin, and what happened to the food in the West Virginia town that Jamie Oliver attempted to make over. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. you remember, back in 2010, the British chef Jamie Oliver did a TV series about Huntington, West Virginia. It had been named the unhealthiest town in America. Well, in the series, Jamie set out to change how the entire town ate, especially targeting school lunch. Well, sparks flew, dramatic television happened, and hosannas were sung to healthy eating. Well, Jane Black, a reporter for the Washington Post, tracked that story, while her husband, journalist Brent Cunningham, became intrigued by it, too. They wondered about the aftermath, once the cameras were gone, and a bigger question. Does the so-called food movement of local, sustainable, organic, and healthy have any impact on most of the country? Well, Jane and Brent are writing a book about their seven-month stay in Huntington. Jane, Brent, welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, good to be here.
So this is what I understand. You two, Jane, you were tracking what was happening with Jamie Oliver's project, the 2 months he spent in Huntington. And Brent, you were interested in it as well. And you two wrote a book proposal just before your wedding. And when you came back from your honeymoon, you had a contract. And so you went to live for 7 months in Huntington.
Right.
So what did you see as the aftermath of the Oliver Project?
Well, people in Huntington across the board were very interested and concerned about what he was doing. But the place that the show focused probably the most was in the schools. And there he sort of went in and, you know, was shocked and horrified that they were eating breakfast pizza and what he called luminescent strawberry milk. And he tried to get them to start cooking from scratch. He said it didn't really matter that the food met the guidelines of the USDA as far as nutrients were concerned, but it wasn't fresh. And of course, what people saw on TV was the school lunch ladies being furious about this and feeling like he was stepping on their toes, and the kids taking those lunches, which are paid for by taxpayer dollars, and dumping them in the trash. What happened in the aftermath was really interesting, because after he left, they were audited by the USDA, who came in and said, well, these meals may be fresh, but they don't meet our requirements for nutrients. And so the head of school food, whose name is Rhonda McCoy, basically could have gone back to the way she'd always been doing everything. And even though on the show she came across as this cold, aloof bureaucrat, clearly the message had gotten through. And what she did over the next summer was redevelop the recipes, change the flavors a little bit, for example, taking some of the garlic out of his garlicky greens so that the kids liked them better. And, you know, within a year, they were basically cooking all their meals from scratch. And I went down there, and I have to tell you, in this kitchen that any New York restaurant would be happy to have, there were 10 cooks making chicken, rolling it in a spice blend, baking it in the oven, taking potatoes, cutting them up, putting them in olive oil, and roasting them in the oven. The meal that I ate there included a salad that had lettuce from a student farmer. It was incredible. And what's even more amazing is that since then, Cabell County, the county that Huntington is in, has trained, I think, 52 of 55 West Virginia counties to do the same. And I would say West Virginia, which is not known as a very progressive state, probably has one of the best school lunch programs in the country.
So the kids are eating the food.
Absolutely. I mean, look, high school kids are never going to say they like school lunch. It's not cool. But they ate it. I didn't see a lot going in the trash can. And having reviewed my fair share of four-star restaurants, I can tell you it's pretty good.
That's great. I mean, that's really the goal of that project, right?
Absolutely.
But you two talk about the fact that you see a much larger problem behind school lunch, the obesity problem, and the health problems that we have in the country.
Yeah, I think we put a lot of pressure on schools to fix all our problems, but I'm not so sure that's the right way to think about this. And I think more broadly what we found in Huntington, and my connection to the place is I grew up an hour from Huntington and I went to college there, so I know it fairly well. Mm-hmm. But it's a largely white working class city. It's where the Rust Belt and Appalachia meet, and for the last 40 years it has struggled to figure out what it is in the post-industrial world. And you have an audience there, people who aren't necessarily poor, they're certainly not rich, they have some disposable income. In other words, they have the wherewithal to use their time differently and to make different choices around food, but they don't see the importance of it. They don't see the value of it. And I think this is what people who want to sort of fundamentally change the way food is produced and consumed in America are going to have to confront going forward, because there are a lot of people like that around the country.
There's something that's always bothered me. It's that business about we know best. We know that local is better, that organic is better. And, you know, it's pretty arrogant when you're on the other side of that.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think we should just make clear that both Jane and I are part of that movement. I mean, a lot of our friends are activists and chefs and food evangelists, all these sorts of things. But what I think happens is you're talking to people who have a whole different set of priorities when you get out into a place like Huntington. And yeah, I think there's a certain resentment of people on the coasts or people who are perceived as sort of urban elites telling you what to do, whether it's, you know, what to eat, how to drive. I mean, the whole country is sort of enduring an anti-regulatory period. And so this sort of gets rolled up into all that, and it becomes sort of part of the culture war.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you're picking up on, Lynn, is this moral tone.
Right.
And I think that, you know, when you look at the history of attempts to change the way Americans eat, you know, back to Sylvester Graham in the 19th century, it was always a moral crusade, and it never worked. Because people don't like being talked to like that. And so what we argue for and what we think is really important is to sort of take that piece of it away and help people to understand, you know, why they want to do it, not why they should do it.
A big thing that we talk about in the book is that the messenger matters. And there's a lot happening in churches around the country with food and diet. And
really? I didn't realize this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And not just at liberal congregations, although, as you would expect, that's where it began. But it's spreading to conservative churches. The church in our book is an evangelical Baptist church. And the pastor is a fairly progressive guy in a lot of ways. He's the son of a United Mine Workers official. And he really sees this as sort of a class war. Mm. And this is still a very religious country. I mean, again, in New York and, you know, perhaps in Minneapolis and St. Paul and urban centers around it, it's sometimes hard to remember that. But it's a very religious country. And the pastor has a lot of influence where people like us, Michael Pollan, you, they wouldn't listen to necessarily. So I think that's one way that you start to make this important to people.
To some extent, some of this is all perfectly obvious. And yet what we find frustrating is that the leaders in the food movement continue to batter us with these grim statistics about the environment and our health and obesity, and it's also miserable and awful and doom and gloom, without realizing that the people that they're trying to reach are just tuning out.
Yeah, even if it's not a situation where they don't believe it, it sort of gets lost in the flurry of daily priorities.
And, you know, we have a 2.5-year-old. So when we were living in Huntington and cooking all of our meals from scratch, we didn't have a 2.5-year-old. And boy, does that change everything. You know, the amount of time and energy and planning and skills that it requires to ask Americans who are used to inexpensive and convenient food to do that is just not going to work. And so we, along with talking about messengers, you know, we're very interested in how we can make healthier food that people like to eat convenient. I mean, we're all for frozen foods, not full of junk and unpronounceable ingredients, but good frozen foods that you can pop in the microwave and feed your kid for dinner. There is nothing wrong with that.
And to the extent that the movement makes you feel like there is something wrong with that, that's a real problem.
A really interesting take and a valuable one. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jane Black and Brent Cunningham are authors of a forthcoming book on the real effects of the food movement and Huntington's efforts to change the way it eats. We've recently learned, to our surprise, that in Berlin, it can be easier to get into an exclusive nightclub than finding authentic spicy Asian food. Evidently, the German palate just doesn't take well to spice. Well, apparently, a group of Thai and Vietnamese immigrants have taken matters into their own hands. Producer Ryan Kyliff brings us the story from Berlin.
Germans know Berlin for its ethnic food, from the famous Turkish market to the Vietnamese and Indian restaurants all over town. But I found one thing missing.
Two.
Heat.
One, two, three, ho!
I've been asking for my food sharp, German for spicy, but the Scoville scale here ranges from about zero to paprika. I was about to give up hope when I got a hot tip on some secret sharpiness, an illegal Asian street food market called Thai Park. Thai Park is in a park on the outskirts of town. I arrive on a Saturday afternoon, and dozens of vendors are set up with mats, umbrellas, and portable gas stoves. There's summer rolls and spring rolls, Penang curry, papaya salad, sticky rice, and chicken satay. There's even Singha beer. But best of all, chilies. Piles and piles of Thai chilies. I follow the sound of a sizzling hot plate and find a woman searing squid, six skewers at a time. I ask one of her customers what's on his plate.
Some calamari, egg rolls, and some spicy pork with salad. You want to try it? It's fantastic.
Thanks.
Enjoy.
That's Jeff. His expat friends have a regular Thai Park tradition. Andrea Robertson organizes the get-togethers.
When we came here 7 years ago, there was no Thai food anywhere that was good or authentic.
Berlin doesn't lack for Asian restaurants, but Andrea's not a fan.
Food-wise, I think this is a lot more authentic and better than a restaurant because a lot of the Thai restaurants feature a lot of German-esque food, so it's not very spicy and not very flavorful. They always put the three chili peppers next to their dishes, and you know it's not spicy at all.
Andrea tells me Thai Park's been around since the 90s. She says it was mostly Asian immigrants at first, but word spread and fetched the ire of the local government, who threatened to shut it down. I decide to grab some more food while I still can.
What is that?
That is papaya salad. Yeah, original from Thailand. Yeah.
That is chaff?
Yeah, bitten chaff, one chaff, or the filling chaff.
Vielenschaf, many spicy.
Knoblauch.
The vendor starts whipping ingredients into a tall clay pot and smashing them with a pestle.
Chili, fish sauce, lemon, that is here, peanuts. Tomato.
Ah, tastes like home. Although...
delicious for you. Is it spicy or not?
Maybe a little bit more.
A little bit more. Oh, you like spices very much. Okay.
Because of the legal issues, most vendors won't let me record them or take pictures. But Tip Sa Tree will.
Can I have a Thai coffee, please?
I think tea is better.
Tip confirms that the local government is on her back. But she's never been kicked out. The vendors have a loophole.
No. We have to... We are doing some picnic. We are not selling anything. If someone comes to give you money, you have not now, later. So, yeah, strange. It's very strange.
That's right. When the authorities show up, the entire park pretends to be having one big picnic. Just a couple hundred best friends hanging out with their bikes and dogs and kids and food.
They must know.
They know, but they have to see you when you get money. It's very strange because they know what are you doing. This is not picnic. Also, police come here to buy. All illegal, but okay. Yeah. In New York, there's no place like this.
After Tip offers me a generous helping of fresh pad see you, I'm ready to hit the drink stand. These two dudes stand out. They're younger than the other vendors, wearing tight jeans, chambray shirts, and fitted ball caps. Oh yeah, and one of them is white.
My name is Sasha. I'm from Germany, from Berlin, born and raised here.
Sasha's partner Vin makes the drinks. Organic, flavored iced teas, caipirinhas, mojitos, while Sasha walks around with free samples, drumming up business.
Which one do you recommend? I like nicht süß.
Not sweet. Yeah, it's no problem. My friend is the best barkeeper in Berlin City, and he can make it for you. Every drink you like. No problem.
I go for a Tiberius jasmine tea with fresh mint and basil. Sasha tells me that they grew up playing soccer in this very park. Vin's parents used to sell food here, and now they do it, for fun and spare change.
So are you the only white guy selling food in Thai Park?
Oh, some of the Thai women here have German husbands, but I think I'm the only one, yes. That's why I brought my Vietnamese partner with me.
I'm ready for dessert, so I tap a girl who's got something sweet.
These are coconut pancakes, like silver dollar pancakes, but made with some kind of rice flour and coconut milk with little green onions in them. Sweet, savory, creamy, really delicious, really addictive.
Natalie's an expat, but her friend Katrin is German. It's her first time at Thai Park. She says a lot of Berliners don't even know it exists. Katrin loves the Asian restaurants in her neighborhood, and she's been to Southeast Asia, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. But the food there wasn't her favorite.
I didn't like it. Yeah, it was quite difficult to find something, actually, that I'm capable of eating. I liked looking at other people eating the things, but not for me.
There's one simple reason that Asian food in Asia didn't sit with Katrin. You guessed it.
The German spicy I like, but when I eat Vietnamese or something, I usually say with no spice. Yeah, it's a lesson learned not to put more spice on it.
A lesson learned for entertaining any German guests, especially if they love Asian food.
I wake up in a cold sweat.
Ryan Kyliff is an independent producer in New York. Now, we have an authentic Thai recipe for you from an authentic Thai food authority, David Thompson. Now, you can make it as hot or not as you like. Find his Thai grilled chicken on the website splendidtable.org. We're going to be back in a minute with your calls and the art of fried fish. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
I'm in the phone booth. It's a one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just ring it off the wall. I know he's there, but I just had to call. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone.
We are talking to you this hour. Okay, let's get to your questions. You can connect with us at 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's see. Who do we have calling? We've got Tom calling from Eugene, Oregon. Tom, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. It's great to talk with you.
Good to talk with you, too. What do you want to talk about?
So, I love cooking, but I'm more of a follow-the-recipe kind of cook. And I know I listen to your show, and I get all kinds of great ideas about how to cook a little bit more creatively. And it doesn't always work out so great for me.
Yeah, but remember, that's how the learning experiences happen. Let's put it this way. I've destroyed more dishes in the past than I've succeeded. So know that it happens to everybody.
So I guess my question for you would be if you could give some advice to those of us who would like to venture beyond the recipe but who are hesitant to fail.
Well, first of all, kidding aside, you don't want to waste food. You know, it's pretty disappointing when you've invested in something and it doesn't turn out and it isn't edible. But I think the best thing to do is to not focus on a recipe, but learn techniques. And the thing about this is that you're always in control when you know the how and the why of what you're doing. And I'll give you an example, okay? Every dish falls into some category. And once you know the category and you understand what the structure of dishes in that category is, you can basically work out almost any recipe you run across that seems to be in that category. To start with, let's talk about making – well, let me ask you this. What do you really enjoy eating? Like, let's pick a dish.
I eat a lot of pasta dishes.
Okay. All right. So when you make pasta, there's a couple of rules. Number one, lots of water. 6 quarts of water for every pound of pasta. Number two, salt the water so that it tastes like a good soup. And number three, keep that water boiling pretty fiercely and stir the pasta. And always drain the pasta when it's still a little firmer than you want it to be. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, that when it makes sense, which is pretty often, undercook the pasta that way, even a little less cooked, and throw it into the sauce and toss it over heat in the sauce so that it starts to absorb the sauce. So there's one technique you now know, and you probably knew before. The other thing is, with tomato sauces, you never overcook a tomato sauce, unless it has meat in it. But most tomato sauces, once the tomatoes are in the pan, need maybe 5-10 minutes of simmering, and that's about it. There were exceptions to the rule. I always make my tomato sauces in big skillets because everything sautés fast. The tomatoes go in. They bubble for maybe 5-10 minutes when I take, and I keep tasting. And once I have the, you know, I want them to still taste fresh, I just pull it off the stove and I put a lid on it. And then when I make the pasta, I put it back over the stove and I toss it all together. And the pasta absorbs a bit of that tomato sauce. So there's the basic idea. If you're going to do, oh, let's say, chops of some kind, pork chops with a sauce, this is called a sauté. And a sauté always begins the same way. Some fat in a big open pan, and you want to brown things in that fat. Medium, medium high heat. Don't rush it. Season it as it cooks with salt and pepper. And you want it golden. And I keep, when it's meat, I keep turning it. It helps make it juicier. And the idea here is you don't want to crowd anything in the pan. You really want to get things crusty. Now, from there, you can pull that out of the pan when it's done. And you could throw wine. You could throw tomatoes. You could add garlic. You could add, you know, any kind of herb. And you remove some of the fat first and scrape that up with some kind of liquid. And you've got a pan sauce.
Hmm. Good idea.
So that's, and there's a couple of books out. There's one new book called 12 Recipes. And it's a chef teaching his son, who's going away to school, how to cook. And it's
that sounds great.
And, you know, it's very good food, but he's explaining every step of the way. And that's the kind of book, not only we have great recipes, but that's the kind of book you can keep referring to again and again.
Uh-huh.
So think in terms of the technique. You master the technique, and you are the king of the hill.
Well, that's great advice. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Take care.
Bye. 800-537-5252. Thomas is calling from Asheville, North Carolina. Thomas, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I've wanted to cook goat for a while. Goat meat. I'm hearing a lot about how it's environmentally sustainable, and I know there's a lot of goat farms in my area. And I've heard it's a popular, you know, meat worldwide. And this year for Thanksgiving, my family's coming to town, and I got them on board. I thought it would be a good excuse to try cooking goat. And I wanted to ask, you know, I got them to agree, let's eat goat this year, but then I don't know what cut of meat to prepare for maybe 8 to 10 people, and you know, maybe wanted some advice on how to prepare it.
Well, first of all, the younger the animal, generally the tenderer the meat's going to be. The older the animal, the stronger the flavor will be, but it will be very, very flavorful. You know, the flavors intensify as the muscles mature and the animal moves around. Generally, goat that is sold, you know, for eating tends to be on the younger side, the way lamb is usually sold. Whenever you're in doubt about any meat, and goat can be kind of lean, cook it low and slow. And I think one of the great ways to do it is chops are really lovely. You know, just the classic, as you would do a lamb chop, the classic goat chop. They're small. You can do them on the grill. You could do a whole rack of them. They tend to be very pricey. The leg, like a leg of lamb, is something that is more meaty. Now, generally, the leg on a goat is small. It's not very big. You may want to get two of them. They would generally be the size that you could easily get two in the oven. And I'm thinking whatever you would do with lamb, you can do with goat. Now, you can do, I mean, one of the things, people tend to spice goat heavily, doing a curry or that kind of thing. But what I would do instead is I would give it a much more traditional Thanksgiving treatment. And it could be done very simply with, you know, taking a knife and making insertions into the meat and then stuffing that meat with things like, well, this is really a little bit of a departure, fresh mint and garlic and basil. And even if you want, you can throw some bits of fruit in there or something that has a sweet overtone. And the idea is you let that sit overnight with that seasoning. It helps just permeate the meat a bit. And then I'd roast it at about 300, 325. And I would be basting it with some wine, probably with red wine, so that the pan juices got really succulent. And if toward the end you wanted to baste it with a little bit of apple cider, it would be fabulous. Or orange, which would be delicious too. But the wine based, where you would start out with probably about 2 cups of wine, and as you slowly, slowly roasted this and you tested it with an instant reading thermometer, you would be basting it with that wine. And baste it in the beginning of cooking, because otherwise the alcohol doesn't burn off. It can be kind of strong. And I wouldn't take it much beyond about 140 and let it sit, because then it's always going to go up 5 degrees. You have to let it rest. Always let it rest about 20 minutes before you actually cut it.
Okay. Do you think I could do the same thing for a rack?
Oh, absolutely. But with a rack, you're going to sear it. You know, they're small. You're going to sear them, and you can even sear them in a big skillet, do them one at a time, and then stick them in the 325 oven to very slowly finish cooking so you get a crusty brown on the outside.
Okay, thank you so much.
You are welcome, and enjoy the goat. It's a great idea. Take care.
Bye.
You can get to us. Go to Facebook, check us out on Twitter, or go to the website. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. David Rosengarten of the Rosengarten Report has been digging into the art of frying seafood, while our producer, Sally Swift, talked to him about his theories on custom coating fish and seafood.
Hey, David, nice to have you back.
Hello, Sally. Good to be here with you.
So rumor has it that you have been musing on fried fish as only you can.
I love fried fish. You know, I grew up with it. It was one of my dad's big production numbers. Like at least once or twice a month, he would bring together, you know, maybe 6 different types of fish and have a fish fry. But the cool thing that my dad did was every fish got its own coating. It was very important to him. And I think, yeah, that's what makes a great fish fry.
That is really special treatment. So do you have a rundown of what coatings for what kind of seafood?
Yeah, I have a few different ideas. You know, most chefs, particularly across the South in the U.S., cornmeal is very popular for fried seafood, particularly for fried oysters. And I've always found that it comes out a little sandy and a little dry when you do it purely in cornmeal. So I did some experiments, and I have a way of frying oysters basically in cornmeal. You put out a plate of flour, and you season that well. And let's make them a little Cajun. So you're going to put some Cajun kind of seasoning in the flour. And then in another bowl, you beat enough egg to just contain the oysters. Then you mix it together, hold it for 5 minutes, let them get good and juicy. And then when you're ready to fry, you pick up an oyster from the egg, you let it drip for a moment, then you roll it lightly in the cornmeal, but then you immediately roll it in the seasoned flour. That outer layer of seasoned flour takes away the dryness, the sandiness, but also leaves the cornmeal flavor. So that would definitely be my way to do it.
And are oysters the only thing you like to use a little cornmeal with, or do you go with other seafood with that?
No, I do it. I mean, you know, fish fillets with the cornmeal batter would be great. Though I do have another way for fish fillets that I'm about to tell you.
Yes, this is your custom coating for fish fillets, correct?
This is it, definitely. And one reason you could say that, not a lot of people know this, but about 7 or 8 years ago, I got involved with the startup of a fish and chips restaurant. And it's in an unusual place. It's in Reykjavik, Iceland.
Wow.
It's called Icelandic Fish and Chips. And it's still running. It's a huge hit. It's one of the most popular restaurants in Iceland. And we use all kinds of fish at the restaurant, you know, local Icelandic fish. But you could do this with anything. I just did it recently with tilapia, or, you know, sole is great for this, or flounder or whatever. And it's basically a yeast batter. my goal when I created this batter was to make it, you know, it can be heavy in England, the fish and chips. I want it to be very light, almost tempura-like. So in a bowl, you put some sifted flour, and then you add a little bit of dry yeast to that, powdered yeast, and you stir in some warm water until it's just like a thick cream kind of texture.
Mm-hmm.
Don't whisk it into a smooth paste. A few lumps are definitely okay. And then you have to hold that batter, because it has the yeast in a warm, draft-free place, like a turned-off oven, for about an hour.
Hmm.
And at that time, you should see like boop, 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 you know, little lacy bubbles coming up. Take your fish fillets, season them with salt, and then if the oil's ready, you're ready. You dip the fillets in the batter, coat it well, allow a little bit of the batter to drip off, but then the fillets go right into the hot oil, and an amazing transformation takes place. They end up being all crunchy and light and airy and bubbly and crenellated on the outside. Really good fried fish.
Oh my God, that sounds delicious. You know, I haven't thought about using yeast in a batter, but that makes absolute sense.
Right. Well, a lot of people do that kind of thing by using beer. You can also use club soda, but I find that the yeast actually does the most of that effect.
Okay, so what is your optimal coating for shrimp?
I love fried shrimp, and there are many ways I like to do it, but shrimp's a good place to bring in the crumbs. Crumbs are probably the most popular or most widely used coating for fried fish. But you got to be careful. I mean, those crumbs that come in the big, tall, you know, canisters like in the supermarket, they're okay, but there's nothing very special or distinctive about them. And you could go to the trouble of making your own crumbs, I suppose. What my dad used to do, he loved a product called Cracker Meal. And I went to about six markets and nobody had them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possible that there's no more Cracker Meal. Anyway, the good news is that they've been replaced, in my mind, by panko crumbs.
So what do you do with them with shrimp?
Okay, if they're shellless shrimp, you just want to dip them in beaten egg, and then you roll them in the panko crumbs, and then you fry them. But if you get the shrimp, the little guys that have the heads and have the thin shell on, which I think is much more of a treat all around, both flavor and texture, here's what you need to do, because the crumbs threaten to fall off of the shell. You roll the shell-on shrimp in flour. Then you dip those shrimp in beaten egg.
Mm-hmm.
Then you roll them lightly in panko crumbs. But then you dip them again in beaten egg, and then one more time in panko crumbs, and that does it. Then
wow, you, crunchy.
It's like really crunchy, crispy. I mean, you could be in the kitchen eating that, and somebody in the next room would say, could you be quiet, please?
So tell me, this is the big taboo for everyone is, of course, cooking with all that oil. What is the rule? How much oil do we need to really cook fish well? And what temp?
Well, the temp is easy. That is roughly 365 to 375 degrees.
Which means you do need to have a thermometer.
It's the best. It's really good to have a deep-fried thermometer. Just keep in mind that the zone that most people fry in is anywhere from 325 to, let's say, 390.
Okay.
But at the 390 end, you're threatening to burn the food. At the 325 end, you're threatening to have the food absorb a lot of the oil. But at 365 to 375, it does not absorb oil, which is great. So if you fry correctly, you know, you don't get a lot of oil in the food. And of course, you know, how much oil you use all depends on how much seafood you're cooking and what the size of your pot is. But I would say, you know, this is a deep fry, so you want to make sure that whatever pot you're using, that you've got at least a couple of inches of oil to fry in.
Lots of room for those things to crisp up.
Yes.
Okay, David, thank you. Great talking to you as usual.
Thank you, Sally. See you soon.
David Rosengarten is the man behind the Rosengarten Report. You can find his recipe for panko-coated shrimp on the website splendidtable.org. Well, would there were more time, but that's the show for this week. Be sure to join us next week, and in the meantime, let me leave you with this from Anonymous, who said, "Give a man a fish, and he eats for a day. Teach a man to fish, and he's gone for the whole weekend." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Visit splendidtable.org to get information on everything you heard here today and so much more. You're going to find recipes. You can register for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Take a look at our e-books and be sure to visit our podcast network, infiniteguest.org. You're going to find Splendid Table there, of course, as well as a collection of other shows like a tiny sense of accomplishment with writers Sherman Alexie and Jess Walter. It's a podcast about works in progress. And every now and then, basketball. Find it at infiniteguest.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.